Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. The series about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. As previously mentioned, the Free Church was started in 1884 when 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with the similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel to the Congolese, start churches, and train up leaders to continue with the work of the church autonomously. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. Much of the early work had helped establish a functioning mission, but much happened during my family's tenure, so I felt that sharing the journey from the beginning, as well as the stories of all those that passed away during the effort, was important. Furthermore, there is a lot of information and history that will be shared that has never been heard or documented, and I'm glad to have captured it to preserve it for future generations. This is part 5 of 7. The first episode told the story of the work of the Free Church Mission starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson. The work faced considerable challenges: poor medical services, disease, slow communication, and minimal funds and staff. Yet, with hard work, 3 mission stations were in place by 1936. But 5 people died during this period. The second episode covered adding 3 more mission stations from 1936 to 1947, and several more people being buried in Congo, succumbing to disease and illness. Episode 3 covered the period from 1948 to 1952, when more mission stations were established, and 1 adult and 1 child died. Episode 4 included more stations being established and the beginning of transferring responsibility to the Congolese church. Congo's independence occurred in 1960, resulting in the evacuation of missionaries. 3 more saints were laid to rest, 2 infants and an adult. And this 5th episode will cover the period from 1963 to 1972. So, let's begin.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
In the early 1960s, the newly independent Congo was in political turmoil. Even though several years had elapsed, the political leadership was not settled and varying forces were fighting for power. The Kasai province and Katanga province had decided to secede. The army was deployed to put down the rebellions. The UN got involved. Mercenaries were hired. It was a total mess. Kasavubu was president and had reunited the country, while Mobutu, who had led the army, had not succeeded in quashing the Katanga rebellion, as the UN had been the predominant force there. So Kasavubu worked to decentralize the government, giving more power to the provinces and the people. Unfortunately, defiance started to show up with some in the government. They influenced the peasants to revolt, much out of the communist playbook. Then, in late 1963, a rebellion started in the eastern part of the country. Laurent Kabila and Che Guevara, the South American rebel, formed a rebel group called the Simbas. Simba is a Swahili word for lion. They believed in black magic and convinced their conscripted soldiers, many of them young boys, that bullets would turn to water when they were shot by the Congo army. Thus, they were virtually fearless as they started to take over villages, towns, and cities on their march west towards the capital. By the summer of 1964, they'd gained control of about 1/3 of the country and were on their way towards the capital. News started to come about the advancing Simba rebels. Finally, the U.S. ambassador notified all Americans that it was time to get out of the country for safety reasons. So the missionaries from both the Covenant and Free Church evacuated. Dr. Paul Carlson and his wife Lois and two children had come to Congo to serve in a small hospital at a mission station called Wasolo in 1963. This station was very distant from the others and was approximately 15 miles from the Ubangi River that separated Congo from the Central African Republic. For many months, Dr. Carlson and his wife Lois, a nurse, worked in the hospital, serving hundreds of people every day with their medical needs, performing surgeries, and the like. With the threat of the Simba rebels moving westward, the Carlson family followed the evacuation orders and left Wasolo to cross the nearby Ubangi River to safety in the Central African Republic. However, Dr. Carlson went back to the hospital after getting the family situated, as he'd done surgery on several patients. He assured his family that he had an escape route to the river and that being a doctor and being so far from the rebels, the chances were low of anything bad happening. Unfortunately, the rebels came to Wasolo on September 18th and blocked his escape route. They shot several key people in the hospital and captured Dr. Carlson. He only had the clothes on his back and a small pocket New Testament in his pocket. News was sporadic about Dr. Paul, and occasionally they'd get radio reports and a few letters reached Lois that had gotten out somehow. He was sent to Bondo, a Catholic mission about 100 miles east, and then on October 23rd, he was sent to Stanleyville. The Victoria Hotel was where 235 American hostages were housed. During his imprisonment, he treated numerous Simba rebels that had been injured in battle, as well as numerous other prisoners that had been beaten and tortured by the rebels. He too endured beatings at the hands of the rebels, yet persevered with his ongoing medical treatments and positive spirit to those around him. By November, there was news that he was accused of being a major in the U.S. Air Force and a spy, and was going to be executed along with several others. On November 18th, several of the prisoners, including Dr. Carlson, were taken to the center of town at the Lumumba Monument, where prior executions had occurred. He leaned to one of his fellow prisoners, and he said,
"I'm going to die today. Please make sure this gets to Lois."
And he slipped his pocket New Testament to his friend. He and his friends were then beaten. Fortunately, after a call from the Prime Minister of Kenya, the execution was called off and rescheduled. President Lyndon Johnson then decided to provide equipment and supplies for a rescue. Early in the morning, on November 24, 1964, Belgian commandos dropped from the sky to free the hostages. Chaos and mayhem ensued as the rebels tried to defend against the 341 trained Belgian paratroopers. The operation was over rather quickly. It is known as the Congo Massacre. The rebels rounded up the prisoners and started shooting them, but the gun jammed. The prisoners scattered and looked for shelter from the mayhem. Dr. Carlson and several others saw a house with a small porch with a walled enclosure. They went to climb over the wall. Dr. Carlson lifted his colleague over the wall to safety, then he tried to climb over. His colleague reached over to help pull him up when Dr. Carlson was shot. In total, of approximately 2,000 total hostages, 144 were killed, including men, women, and children. I interviewed Lois Carlson, and here is her story of the paratroopers' rescue mission.
They were held in this one big hotel, and then they got them out and put them in this great big square, you know, threatened to shoot them and all that sort of thing. But it wasn't until, the planes were coming over, I guess, somebody let off a shot, and that started shooting. And so then all the prisoners just scattered and looked for shelter. And so, it was just complete chaos. So then when the airplanes, of course, left and everything, and they started, finding out. So I don't know how many were killed over there. It was random shooting because they weren't looking for anybody. They were just, one shot set them all off. And then they found out that Paul and this other missionary had fled and were climbing onto a porch that had a railing around it. And Chuck went over and reached back to pull Paul up, and he dropped a bullet had hit him.
It didn't take long for the news to reach Lois and her family that Dr. Paul Carlson had been killed. The body was flown to Leopoldville, the capital, along with many of the other Americans that had been killed in the rescue effort. They were put in a hangar, and Dan Erickson went to the airport to identify the body. After the shock of the news, Lois contacted Dr. Paul's family in the U.S. about where he should be buried. Dr. Carlson's family let Lois decide the final resting place.
And they said their choice would be to have him buried in Congo, but they said, it's your decision.
She knew Paul would want to be buried in Congo. The body was flown upcountry to Gemena to be transported by truck the 50 miles to Karawa at the missionary cemetery. Congolese lined the road to pay tribute to Dr. Carlson. He was buried at Karawa. It was a large funeral and one filled with tremendous sadness from the Congolese, as he was beloved by them for his medical efforts and compassion. The 15th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Dr. Paul Carlson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
The death of Dr. Paul Carlson was international news. He was on the front cover of Life magazine and Time magazine in December 1964. Every major newspaper in the world had articles and photos of the Stanleyville paratrooper mission, and also photos of Dr. Carlson, thanks to a Life magazine photographer that had visited Wasolo several months prior. So with all the trauma and stress of several months of not knowing about her husband and the finality of his death and burial, Lois decided to stay in Africa for a few months. Upon her return to the U.S., she decided to write a book about her husband's life. The title of the book is Monganga Paul. This means My Dr. Paul in Lingala. For a much more detailed story of Dr. Paul Carlson's capture, imprisonment, and subsequent funeral, you can listen to episode 19 of my podcast. His story of service and ultimate sacrifice prompted people stateside to establish a foundation to carry on his medical work and legacy. In 1965, the mission felt it safe enough for the missionaries to return to the field. So our family, who had been waiting since 1964, arrived on the field. My parents became the dorm parents at the Ubangi Academy, and Dad was one of the teachers there. So things got back to normal. But then, in November 1965, General Mobutu pulled off a coup d'etat and took over the country. Again, more political and government instability for the country. So with the memory of the recent evacuation and then ongoing instability, the missionaries appealed to the board for an airplane. With the renewed energy of growing the mission work, the Free Church and Covenant felt a plane could help with transportation for meetings, conferences, ferrying children to school, and medical emergencies. So in 1966, they partnered with Mission Aviation Fellowship, with the acronym MAF, to provide a pilot. The purchase of the plane was $22,500, with the cost being split 50-50 between the Free Church and Covenant. Bulldozers began to work on making an airstrip at Karawa, and my dad ran some of the equipment. A hangar was built, and a Cessna 185 tail dragger with a luggage pod on the bottom was delivered on April 23, 1966. The plane was painted red and white, and the call letters of the plane were 9QCMU. Charlie Mike Uniform became the name we all referred to when talking about the plane. Gordy Fairley was the first MAF pilot to fly and help get the mission airstrips set up in the spring of 1966. He was followed by John Fairweather in June 1966. The plane was very effective, cutting a 10 to 12 hour trip on a bumpy, dusty, or muddy road down to 1 hour. All the mission stations had to carve airstrips out of the forest or grasslands. This meant leveling, digging out huge termite anthills in some cases, or chopping down trees in a jungle area. Over the next few years, all stations were successful in this work, so the plane could take off and land safely. The mission work continued to grow so that this plane was in constant use, flying people and luggage and supplies all over the Ubangi region. In 1984, another plane was purchased and was also supported by MAF, and that plane was based at Tandala. For a previous podcast, I interviewed Dan Carlson, who grew up being flown around in Charlie Mike uniform as a child. He then became a pilot for MAF, spending his career in Africa, with some of his time based at Karawa in the 1980s and early 1990s. For a more thorough understanding of the MAF airplane and its huge impact on the mission work and church work, I urge you to listen to Episode 4 on my podcast website, www.congokid.net. With the evacuations and rebellion in the rearview mirror, the church that was under the MEU umbrella started to show signs of division. For example, at the conference in August 1966, some delegates asked that the budget be divided between the East and the West. This motion failed to carry, but it began a terminology which went beyond the optics of being divisive. Soon the East became synonymous with the Covenant mission stations and the West for the Free Church area. Then, news of the simmering division along the denominational lines reached the boards for the Free Church and Covenant in the U.S. So at the September 1966 joint board meeting, they wrote to the Congo Free Church requesting that the Ubangi Church remain as one unit, in spite of the fact that two denominations were behind them in America. In the U.S., the two boards continued to meet in joint sessions and stayed united in their goal of keeping the work in Congo together. Since essentially the 1930s, this joint relationship had worked well. Their official position statement was as follows.
To maintain a basic policy relationship with the churches, which will not deter possible future cooperation and/or union.
In short, the Free Church and Covenant would coordinate basic policy, even though they worked on separate sides of the field. Meanwhile, there began talk about Gemena and the Congolese Covenant Church wanting to establish a work there. Again, the U.S. boards were united when they responded.
We urge our missionaries to encourage the two church bodies to observe the established boundaries for the work of the respective groups.
So going forward, the Congolese Free Church continued to resist the Congolese Covenant Church's efforts to put Gemena into its territory. As mentioned in a previous episode, after Dr. Paul Carlson was martyred, many leaders felt it worthy to establish a foundation to honor his work. They established the Dr. Paul Carlson Foundation. Due to his unplanned notoriety of being the face of the Congo Massacre in 1964 and his story of being worldwide news, money flowed in. Harvey Widman was named the first director of the Paul Carlson Foundation. It should be noted that in 1963 and 1964, Dr. Paul Carlson and his wife Lois would drive by Loco, an abandoned hospital facility, coming and going to Wasolo. Lois Carlson told me when I interviewed her some years ago.
And we had heard about this hospital that had been built at Loco by the Belgians, but they had, when they had to flee, they just, you know, left everything. And so we looked at it, and Paul said, oh, if we could only get that. But he said that would make the medical work overbalance all the other work. If we could just, you know, have that hospital, because all brick, I mean, it was built really nice. And I think at the time it even had beds in it, and I guess it had been even medications and everything. But the paratroopers had used it, and it had been used. But they had indoor plumbing in it. So after Paul died and they started talking about some work over there, I thought, that was Paul's dream. And so that kind of got things started.
Well, they didn't know that his wish would come true, and they had no idea the cost of that wish coming true. Harvey Widman and Carl, or Cully Edstrom, also remembered the abandoned hospital facility at Loco. In the late 1950s, the Belgian government had built and furnished a leprosarium at Loco, an isolated area a ways away from Karawa. It had electric generators and a water source that allowed for water towers to gravity feed water to the hospital and some 40 homes for patients and staff. The government stocked everything, including x-ray machines, surgical equipment, and furniture. By 1960, when it was ready to open, the country was given its independence. The Congolese weren't prepared to operate it, with most Belgians having evacuated due to the unrest. Realizing its value, the new Congolese government sent soldiers to guard this wonderful infrastructure. But alas, much of the furniture, fixtures, and equipment had been pilfered, but some still remained. However, the hospital and accompanying homes and clinic remained unused for years. So Harvey and Cully appealed to the new government to allow the foundation to use the property. Several folks met with President Mobutu, and he approved the deal. He also donated 5,000 acres of additional property to help them with their proposed agricultural program. It was 1967. Dr. Wally Thornblum was named the new director, and on March 20, 1968, the dedication ceremony took place. I attended the dedication, but I don't remember much, being 5 years old at the time. The name was Institut Médical Évangélique Dr. Carlson, or the acronym IMEDOCA, IMEDOCA. The dedication was a big deal, with representatives from International News Service, the Congo Minister of Agriculture, the American Ambassador, and other dignitaries. There was a band and everything. Money continued to come in, which funded all the systems, infrastructure, furnishings, electrical system, and supplies. They built an airstrip at Loco. Then, in the fall of 1968, a team from the foundation went to Washington, D.C. to visit the Surgeon General seeking a grant for research on Borrelia ulcers and filaria. The grant was given, and supplies were flown to Loco, and now Loco Hospital was in full operation. However, as the grant money ran out, the operations suffered. Then, shortly thereafter, Dr. Wally Thornblum suffered a heart attack, leaving the hospital without a doctor. His replacement, Dr. Cletus Olson, was there for a short period of time, and then he left for other duties. Enter Dr. Titus Johnson. He'd been asked to fill in and provide coverage. It should be noted that the locals felt the hospital facility was cursed, jinxed, as it were. It had been built, then abandoned, then looted, then resurrected, then left to start to deteriorate. So without much support from the local population, Dr. Titus faced yet another daunting task. He rolled up his sleeves, hired workers, and with his typical enthusiasm, got the grass cut, planted trees and manioc, and installed a fish pond. True to form, Dr. Titus also secured some ducks to raise and built a pen for cattle, so once funds were available, they could be purchased. The workers cleaned the facility, and patients started to show up for consultations and surgeries. Soon, medical duties filled his day, and the locals began to feel the curse had been lifted, so they cooperated more and the spirit changed at Loco. By August of that year, a young couple, Verl, a mechanic with farm experience, and Jan, a nurse, Peterson, arrived to help. Dr. Titus had been virtually alone for months, so their arrival brought much-needed help and companionship. His visa was set to expire in December, so besides handling all the medical issues, he also undertook more landscaping projects, pushing back the jungle, planting trees and plants, and creating a beautiful campus. He then left Loco and returned to Sweden and the U.S. Then, he was asked in March 1970 to return to Loco to help the new doctor, Dr. Tolles, settle in. There were personality and style conflicts between the two, so he then moved on to Asolo to work at that hospital. Then he was off to Tandala and Kala to help, returning back to Loco then in June 1970. Then he returned to Pinga in eastern Congo. I've asked Paul Norin, who I've known since the 1960s and grew up in Congo, and then returned and worked with the Paul Carlson Foundation at Loco in agriculture and fish ponds, to share about Loco. Paul recounts his first encounter with Loco when he was in the second grade.
So I was 7 years old, and we went by it all the time. You can see these red roofs on the hospital from the far hill, you know. We knew it was Loco, but none of us had ever been in there. So I was in the expedition that went there to check it out, the very first one. And it wasn't that many years later. I mean, for a kid, it seems like a long time, but it was only You know, it's like 6 years later, the thing's being dedicated. You know, so Paul Carlson's dream was really quite, I mean, he was the one who said, there's a hospital sitting there, we might as well take it and use it. And sure enough, we did. But unfortunately, he died in the meantime.
The total property is a bit over 5,000 acres. Here is an overview of the layout of the mission station.
It was set up as a leprosarium in the 1950s. And so it's on top of a hill, and there's a water source down at the bottom, 375 feet down. And so it's up pretty high there. And with some forest and then some open areas. And yeah, it was kind of on top of the hill. There was sort of a hot, treeless kind of a spot where they put the hospital. And you're looking out over a valley across the way, and then all the way out to this really big forest. It just goes and goes into 10,000 square miles of forest out there. So that's kind of the setting of kind of where Loco was.
The station was divided into two sections.
Okay, so the mission is divided up into two sort of sections. You have the hospital, and then down beyond the hospital, just a little bit, not there was about four or five houses there in a row. And over the years, we added another six or seven on the other side of the road from that. So there's a forest between the hospital and then up where the two main houses that the Belgians put in. And that was for a doctor and for some nuns on the other side of the mission. You walk through this forest. It's about half a kilometer away. So anyway, it's divided into these two sections. And the upper section where, you know, the missionaries were living up there, and engineer and BO. And then there was what they called a big camp. And the camp, there are rows of long, you know, long cement buildings. And it's just rows of these things, probably three or four rows deep. And those were supposed to be for leprosy patients. So there was like a living room and a bedroom. That was basically what each little unit had. Well, that became workers' housing because it never became a leprosarium. And the whole station is about from the center out to the road, it's almost 3 kilometers. So it's out there in the middle of nowhere.
At its peak, there were four missionary doctors and two Congolese doctors. It was a busy and bustling hospital. They added other dimensions to the work, including fish ponds and cattle.
I think it started out with Titus Johnson, with the fish ponds to begin with, and with a cattle herd. So they started out getting cattle from a number of different places, and they started a small cattle herd. And back in 1968, they'd already got that going. And then Arden Almquist came along, and he was interested in the agricultural aspect of things too, because of nutrition. Seeing a lot of problems that people come in to the hospital with where actually good nutrition would have prevented it. And so when I was there in 1976, he was already looking into trying to get some kind of an agricultural program going.
Wanting to improve nutrition, Dr. Arden Almquist pushed for new programs.
That program really started a lot of stuff. We did a lot of trials on beans of different kinds. After all the trials, the beans that were working the best for that area and that people wanted were these one of the cowpeas. Okay, so we had two or three varieties of that we also used, but that were good for that area. That became part of the culture now. I mean, it's just everyone has cowpeas nowadays, and so that was really successful. And the fish culture program that I was in charge of then for almost 10 years, we ended up with 26,000 ponds. But that was what happened, starting with the USAID program. And then they got a Heifer Project International thing for expanding cattle herds. And the goal was 25 new herds. We ended up with 130. So it worked pretty well. It's a kind of a lend lease kind of a thing. You get the cows back after a certain amount of time and give them on to someone else, pass on the gift. And so there was all that going on at the same time. So it was a pretty big deal. So the agricultural program became a really big thing at Loco.
One of the iconic aspects of Loco were the two water towers installed by the Belgians in the 1950s. These were 75 feet tall and initially run by electric motors, then by a diesel generator, then a centrifugal pump, and more recently, a water wheel. They captured the stream water in a dam that fed to a cistern that then got pumped into the two water towers to gravity feed to the property. Each tower held 24 cubic meters of water, or about 6,300 gallons. Loco is special to Paul and his wife Cheryl because it was home for them.
Our kids were born there, raised there, you know, and their best friends, you know, the Danforth kids and the Extrand kids, and then the Bio's kids over there. Our kids were over at their place all the time, and their kids were over at our place eating Swedish pancakes as well, and just in and out. It was a wonderful situation for our kids there. Wonderful. And they had really good African friends, and these guys were colleagues of ours. And Bio ended up being our boss. And he's still around. I mean, he's a really good friend. Every time I'm at Loco, we get together.
So that is the story of Loco, a hospital built for helping leprosy patients that never opened, was deeded to the Paul Carlson Foundation, and has been serving the area since 1968 in medical, spiritual, agricultural, and animal husbandry ministries ever since. In 1991, the Paul Carlson Foundation agreed to consolidate its administration with the Covenant Church to expand the ongoing medical and agricultural ministries of the Covenant. This also provided more support to the organization and has allowed the work to expand to other countries in furtherance of Dr. Paul Carlson's vision of expanding ministries beyond Congo. The rumblings of division continued in the Congolese church. In addition, the Congolese church was looking for more autonomy from the mothership denominations in the States. How the affairs were to be handled between the Congolese church, the ECU, and the Free Church Missions Council was being drafted by a joint committee. The proposal boiled down as follows. 1. There remain one legal charter. 2. That the church assume ownership of all mission property. 3. That the church decide which missionaries can come to Congo, where to place them, and where said missionary would be living. And 4. And if the missionary received any government subsidy or salary, say from being a school teacher, those funds went into the church's account. But besides this proposed shift in responsibility, authority, influence, and physical assets, the ECU Council had its own issues. A schism was on the horizon. For instance, there was a disagreement as to the budget for each region, based on membership. Those numbers weren't trusted. Then the Tandala pastors didn't want pastors from Karawa to be in Gemena. Then one of the Karawa regions, the Banga Kungu region, which was part of the covenant, wanted to start working in a suburb of Gemena. Remember that Gemena was part of the West and was historically a Free Church area. So the simmering pot continued its temperature rise. The Free Church mission and the ECU's relationship continued to be strained. Then a big event occurred, further rendering a division. The ECU Council held a meeting in December 1970, and they adopted some new rules. First, the Congo Church would have complete control of the missionary. Second, all funds for the missionaries, including salaries, had to flow through the church's treasury. Third, the church treasurer would take 10% tithe before remitting the funds to the missionary. Fourth, the mission had to provide a $60,000 annual subsidy to the Congo Church with no term limit. And fifth, the national church would operate the secondary schools. They would lower acceptance standards, discontinue chapel, could hire non-Christians as teachers, and could use the missionary teachers' government salaries to run the church. Wow. These were all pretty tough and abrupt demands from the Congolese church. Clearly, this was not looking like the smoothest transition of responsibilities. These demands and unilateral decisions had been pre-discussed between the president of the ECU, Alengi Magbia, and Elonda Paul, who was overseer for the national church groups in the Equator province. Apparently, they had implemented the same set of demands downcountry with the Disciples of Christ mission 8 years prior. Well, that resulted in their missionary count going from 75 down to 12. What does that tell you? So how did the home boards respond to these new demands? Well, they planted their flag. The home board replied by a letter and stated that the missionaries needed to be responsible only to the sending church, which was the U.S. they also had to be assured of housing that the mission paid for and maintained, and that the salary given to the missionary for his work be under his or her jurisdiction. If this wasn't acceptable, the home board would assume that the national church no longer wanted or needed missionaries, and that the home boards would look for other mission fields to place them. The letter was firm and straightforward. No doubt the ECU wasn't planning on such a strong pushback, as the letter was more of a scud than a BB gun. The home board was not going to bend to the ECU's posturing and demands. So the Congolese church acquiesced to operate per the original 1969 agreement that everyone had been operating under. The only thing the ECU wouldn't fold on was the missionaries having an annual fellowship conference. They felt that it was a colonial carryover of the whites having their own meetings to decide policies of what was best for the church. And now, with the Congolese in charge of their processes and procedures for the church, they didn't want this to happen. The home boards agreed to this on a trial basis. The mission realized the importance of the written word in the local language, Lingala. The schools had been teaching students how to read and write, and the Bible Institute was turning out pastors to help start churches in the area. While there were three main tribes in the area the mission worked in, the predominant trade language was Lingala. So efforts had begun in 1954 by Sigurd Westberg and Mr. John Carrington, a missionary with another group, to begin working together to translate the Bible into Lingala. Portions were completed over the years. They finished in 1970. It was a day of much celebration when the entire Bible in Lingala was distributed. I remember when they announced the completion of this huge task. A copy was given to each pastor and school teacher in memory of Florence Lumblad. This is still the Bible in use today for Lingala speakers. I have one on my shelf here at home. The Covenant Mission decided to have a 50th year anniversary celebration and invited Dr. Titus Johnson to attend. Both Covenant and Free Church missionaries converged on Karawa to celebrate. At Karawa, the workers had worked overtime to trim the bushes and trees and cut the grass to spruce up the landscaping, as they knew that Dr. Titus always wanted to present a pleasant environment for the missionaries and the Congolese. Also, he had planted the palm trees that now were nearly 50 years old and lined the main road into the mission station and the large field in between the houses. The festivities started at 10 a.m., November 17, 1970, and he entered in the back of a pickup truck with a bicycle also seated next to him, symbolic of his main means of transportation from the 1920s. The roads were lined with Congolese, cheering and honoring this man who had brought Christianity to them so many years ago. Tito, 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 they yelled. There were 70 missionaries and 2,000 Congolese there. I remember that day well, as we didn't have school that day at the Ubangi Academy, where I was attending third grade. There was dancing, and dramas were acted out as part of the festivities. Recall the first church service at Karawa when Titus Johnson had first arrived in the early 1920s. This is when two warring villages started fighting, and numerous people were injured and wounded with spears and machetes, and young Titus had to patch them up as best he could. Well, that legendary story was acted out. I remember vividly where maybe 30 Congolese men, dressed for war, carrying spears and machetes, reenacted that scene. Drums were beating, the warriors were chanting and dancing and flailing their spears all over. One of the warrior actors came up to me and thrust his spear about a foot from my face. Whoa! Yes, I was scared. It was wild. The ceremony moved into the church building. Many people spoke. The fruit of Dr. Titus Johnson's efforts was shared by the numerous Congolese. One man, Saba, said,
I was a warrior. We were all pagans. God saved us to become his children. Aren't we glad to hear and see Tito again?
The crowd roared its agreement. Another man said,
I once refused to believe the gospel, and now I have embraced it. Look at him. I rejoice in him. He came with the good news.
Dr. Titus had his time at the podium, and though his Lingala was not very good, if one listened carefully, one could understand what he was saying. One Congolese mother was heard telling her children,
Now, listen and remember, this is a great day, and this is a great man.
There was food and feasting, and the day finally came to an end. Titus Johnson was now 73 years old. He had suffered two heart attacks, uncounted bouts of malaria, years of work in a harsh climate at an unprecedented pace that had impacted his physical body. He recused himself to his room for the night, weary from the long day of memories, celebration, and seeing the fruit of his vision from 50 years prior. He later wrote in his diary,
A great week at Karawa. It was too wonderful. 50 years in Congo.
In March 1972, he returned to Congo, to Loko, and picked up with his landscaping work and medical work. Again, keeping up a tremendous pace for a 74-year-old. He also filled in at Karawa Hospital. He then went to Karawa in June to speak at the graduation ceremony at the Ubangi Academy, where I was attending. I was in fourth grade, and he was a legend, so it was an honor for him to be there. In September 1972, there was a second 50-year celebration to commemorate his work in the Ubangi. The festivities started at Libengi, then moved to Kala, then ended at Tandala. This celebration was described as having a level of pageantry that included parades, music, presentations, and introductions. Dignitaries were there. Bob Dylan, a former missionary, noted that
it was an African service by Africans for Africans.
Others said there were rivers of people. Doko Kambeke, one of the native pastors, recalls in particular that Titus
cried as he preached, tears of joy, because when he first came, only one person believed, and now there were so many.
Doko later said,
He knew that his time for going back to God was near, and that he could go with a heart at peace.
It was a great celebration to recognize the pioneering work of Dr. Titus and their other early missionaries in their starting the Tandala Hospital, which had become a key medical facility for the entire region. He turned 75 a week later, then went back to Loko to continue his work there. It should also be noted that while the accolades from the missionaries and Congolese honoring Dr. Titus were all fine and great, another honor was also bestowed upon him by the country. President Mobutu selected Dr. Titus to receive the National Order of the Leopard, which is the highest honor given to a white man by the government. There are only a few non-dignitary, non-citizen recipients. Mobutu's private jet took him and an associate to Kinshasa for the ceremony. So on April 29, 1973, he received the highest civilian honor from the country that he'd served for so many years. Well deserved. In 1970, one of the largest projects ever undertaken began at Karawa. This was led by Bob Thornbloom. The help of the U.S. government through USAID was enlisted, as well as that of other countries, mainly Germany, and the hydroelectric project at Zulu began. Workmen began cutting trees, digging, and breaking up rocks to construct the dam. They also used dynamite to blow up some of the larger rock configurations. Zulu was the name of a river that had a waterfall with approximately 8 feet of drop, located about 4 to 5 miles from Karawa. We kids often would go there to swim and play on and around the waterfall. The water was cold coming out of the forest. I remember in high school in the 1970s walking around in the jungle behind the waterfall with Bob Thornbloom. He explained how they'd surveyed the area, determined where to put the dam, and how they would be capturing the power of the river in massive turbines to create 24-hour electricity for the entire Karawa Mission Station. This would meet a very real need for electricity day and night for lights and machinery. It would also serve the hospital, the Ubangi Academy, the missionary homes, and numerous other buildings like schools, the church, and some Congolese homes. It was a 14-year process, and Bob and Jan Thornbloom pursued it tirelessly, soliciting funds and grants to finish the project. I remember in late 1977, there was an airlift with equipment from Germany. A Hercules C-130 Army cargo plane flew from Europe loaded with a backhoe and other large pieces of equipment. They planned to land in Gemena, about 50 miles from Karawa, as that was the only airport long enough to accommodate the plane. It was night, and unfortunately, the landing lights weren't working at the Gemena airport. So the plane began to circle. Gene Bradford went to the control tower and confirmed it was the right plane and arranged for landing. The pilot told Gene that he had limited fuel, so unless he could land soon, he'd be turning around. A bunch of folks, including my dad, drove their trucks to the airport, and by turning on their headlights at each end of the airport, the plane was able to land successfully. In short order, they unloaded their cargo and roared off back to Germany. Gene Bradford and another person spent the night on the tarmac at the airport to provide security for all the equipment and materials. In February 1984, the generators at Zulu began sending electric current to Karawa. 14 years of planning and work were climaxed with great festivities attended by the President of Congo, Mobutu, his wife, the American ambassador, and other dignitaries. Bob Thornbloom, with his original vision, expertise, and hard work, was assisted the last few years by Bob Bergstrom and Leonard Halleck. Many Zairians worked very hard over many years to bring this dream of a hydroelectric dam to a reality. Previously, Karawa had to depend on diesel fuel and generators to run the lights from 5:15 p.m. to 9:15 p.m. each night, or for surgeries at the hospital. If fuel wasn't available, then no lights. Or if the generator had a mechanical problem, then no lights. Now, after 14 years of perseverance and considerable effort, Karawa had 24-hour electricity. So by the early 1970s, 50 years had elapsed and the mission work had matured and the mission station was developed. You've heard the story and journey of Karawa to this point. But let's hear more about Karawa and its impact and personality. I've asked Doug Thorpe, who lived there from 1966 to 1979, with the last year being a short-termer, to highlight this station.
Karawa had several major components to its mission. Probably the largest one was the medical work. So the hospital, the nursing school, the houses for both the expatriate medical staff, the doctors and nurses, also some of the Congolese medical staff, the medical directors, some of the nurses, later some of the doctors. So that was a substantial number of buildings, and it grew over the time that we were there. Then there was the Ubangi Academy for educating the missionary kids. So the buildings associated with UBOC, the dorm, the school, and then houses for faculty members of that. Then there was service technique, the technical services for the mission, so mechanical services to keep all the vehicles running, but also kind of the central hub for construction at all the various mission stations. So there was Bob Thornbloom, the chief mechanic. There were almost always some short-term missionaries associated with that, and sometimes a missionary builder as well. There. And then there was the small airplane for Missionary Aviation Fellowship and the pilot and the pilot's family. So a lot of different things. It ended up being a lot of buildings.
He describes the topography.
It was largely grassland surrounding the mission and still forested on the actual mission itself, including a few just a very few forest giants that were old, old trees there. I remember talking to some of the old-timers, Kinzawa, who cooked for the pilots, who was probably born in the 1910s or maybe early 20s. And he said when he was a child, they were not allowed to go play up on the hill because there were too many elephants up there in the forest. So it had definitely changed from maybe the 20s to the 60s and 70s.
Here is the history of the water supply.
So it changed over time. When we got there in 1966, the water source was rainwater collected off the roof of houses. We had a large cistern underneath the back porch of our house. I collected water, and it was pumped up from that cistern by hand and distributed by bucket to the other houses. So Bob Thornton got a small grant to put in a water wheel at Booty. Booty's about 3 kilometers, 2 miles away, up over the crest of Caraway Hill and then down to the west. And he basically constructed a very small dam, a spillway out of 55-gallon drums split lengthwise with the ends knocked out of them, welded together, and then a water wheel based on an old truck chassis. So he used the rear axle of the truck as the main axle, hung the water wheel off an old truck wheel, used the differential and the drive shaft of that truck to come up to a pulley that spun a pump, and pumped water up the hill to a tank that he built at the top of Caraway Hill, and then gravity fed to the hospital and all the houses. It's a remarkable, remarkable engineering feat.
You've heard about the hydroelectric project called Zulu.
Caraway had to generate all its own electricity. There's no public utility. So there was electricity for a few hours in the morning for the hospital to do laundry and surgery, and then a few hours in the evening to light the missionary houses and make dinner. And then if there was emergency surgery in the middle of the night, the diesel generators had to come on. But getting diesel fuel shipped all the way up to Caraway was a constant stress. So Bob had this vision of putting in a hydroelectric plant at Zulu, a somewhat mid-sized river, small river, and a turbine to generate 24/7 electricity for Caraway.
Doug assisted for 1 year on that project.
My year as a short-term missionary, 78 to 79, I devoted most of my time to working on getting started out at Zulu. So we had cleared some of the trees upstream where you were walking there. I designed and built the garage to house the equipment out there. So we got that going, and then we started putting in temporary dams upstream so that we could dry out and prepare the bed where the permanent structure would go. So that's as far as we got in 78, 79.
I asked Doug what made Caraway special.
As a station kid, I had the best of both worlds. I had all my friends at the Ubangi Academy. I could play with them all afternoon. Then I could go home and be with my family and sleep in my own bed at home at night. Just wonderful. So that was part of what was really great about living at Caraway. Also, the fruit trees on the station, especially around our house, were really quite wonderful. We had an orange tree for a while. You could just climb up in the orange tree and pick your own oranges. We had a huge mango tree. We had a rose apple tree in our backyard, avocados, guavas. I ruined my appetite for supper on more than one occasion by spending the whole afternoon picking and eating fruit. Just wonderful. I think the other thing that really made living at Caraway special was the presence of all these short-term missionaries. They were colorful people. They were young adults in their early 20s. We idolized them as kids. They were very good to us as kids. So watching them in action and trying to emulate what young grown-ups did was really important.
Caraway continued to be the largest station for the Covenant folks. It had a large hospital, the main garage and mechanical services area for all the stations, and the Ubangi Academy for teaching and boarding all the kids grade 2 through 12. It also served as the original base for the Cessna 185 airplane, sponsored by Mission Aviation Fellowship. President Mobutu was a brilliant politician. He knew that he needed to unify this diverse country, counting about 250 tribes in a very large area. These tribes and groups had been in conflict for years and had endured oppression as well. The people had been subject to King Leopold II's atrocities of slavery, amputations, and murders. This period was followed by Belgium as colonizers from 1908 to 1960, whereby the Congolese were second-class citizens with minimal rights. Then the first 5 years of independence was a political, social, and economic train wreck until he staged his coup d'etat in 1965. He'd already declared all political parties illegal except for his party, the MPR, the Popular Movement of the Revolution. So in October 1971, he decided to shed all things Western from the country and change the name from Congo to the Republic of Zaire. He was pushing for the country to have its own identity, its own authenticity. This meant changing of all names that were Western in nature, such as Paul, Thomas, or John, and meant that you had to come up with an African name like Kokenago or Balewele or Talabisa. Joseph Désiré Mobutu became Mobutu Sese Seko Nkukungbendu Wazabanga. Translated, it means the all-powerful warrior who, because of his endurance and inflexible will to win, will go from conquest to conquest, leaving fire in his wake. No, I'm not making that up. I guess if you're the dictator and are going to change your name, you might as well not only go big, but really big. Attire was also on the docket, so no more Western suits and ties. Rather, a modified suit that Mobutu designed and a neck kerchief became the formal attire. Interesting, but the neck piece is called an abacost, based on none other than Communist China's Mao Zedong's own. Mobutu had recently visited China, so neckties, like the Western folks wore, were forbidden. He donned a leopard skin hat and had a carved wooden cane he carried around. This became his signature look. He was trying to portray being their king. And reference to others became calling your fellow Zairean a citoyen, which is French for citizen. Sort of like in the Soviet Union, you call people comrade so-and-so. Here you called out to someone such as citoyen Kokenago, or citoyen Segbewi, or citoyen Liabina Mundoki Matata, or whatever his name was. About this time, the Église du Christ au Congo, or the Church of Christ in Congo, with the acronym ECC, became a reality. It was an umbrella organization under which every church denomination in the country was urged to be part of for political influence and protection. It was an attempt to be governed by a one-church plan. The name changed to the ECZ when Congo changed its name to Zaire in 1971. Many of the church and mission groups had concerns about being part of this. Bob Dylan, former missionary to Congo and now with the Free Church Home Board, noted that 43 out of 65 national church and mission boards refused to be part of the, quote, one church plan, unquote. However, the law required that a church had to be part of the ECZ. If not, they were told, they would be unrecognized and operating illegally. So the mission fulfilled the requirement by the March 31st deadline, but were not accepted. Yet later, a list was printed in a newspaper that everyone was part of the ECZ, whether they chose to be or not. If your head is reeling a bit, so is mine. Imagine the seesaw effect on the mission boards and missionaries on the field during this crazy time. Their role was being challenged, their legality jerked around, and they were forced to be part of something they didn't want to be in. Later, any church group became a, quote, community, unquote, under the umbrella of the ECZ, and allowed to have its own charter and maintain their own doctrinal positions within the ECZ. So the Congolese church that had been with the Free Church changed its name to Communauté Évangélique du Christ en Ubangi, or the Evangelical Community of Christ in the Ubangi. The acronym was CECU. The Covenant Mission and its church eventually became the Communauté Évangélique du Lubangi Mongala, or the Evangelical Community of the Ubangi Mongala. That acronym is the CEUM. I wish I could say that the posturing and politics and strained relationship between the mission and the Congolese church for the previous few years was done, and things would settle down in a new working relationship and parameters. But I'd be wrong. A year or so later, the Zaire government issued an executive decree that abolished all mission organizations, effective March of 1972. This meant that the Free Church missionaries had to work under the CECU and the legal charter and direction of the church. The covenant, however, being under the CEUM, had their representatives press for having the original MEU charter signed over to them. Remember that it was back in the 1930s when the covenant first went to Congo that they worked under the Free Church's legal entity. Now they wanted that charter to go to them. Craig Wickstrom had lunch with his dad, Marv Wickstrom, in May 2026, and they discussed this time period. Marv explains that Art Lumblad didn't want to transfer the MEU charter to the Covenant Congolese Church, as he felt that maybe, in the future, there might be a need for the entity to stay valid for future missionary endeavors. Marv felt it would be a simple thing just to change the names on the documents and effect the transfer that way. Here's Marv.
I submitted a change, and I did it all on my own, basically. And it was a mistake, as I think back on it completely. But I thought it would be an easy way for the CUM to get a person out of Seville. And then they would just take over the CUM and just put their names in. That particular time, Duarte was president and I was vice president. So there was a missionary's name on there, see. Yeah, we would have had to have met as the officers of the MEU to make a decision that we were to give this to a church and then see what the Justice Department would do with that. But instead, I come down on my own.
Lee Hegel later wrote that the statutes of the MEU were modified to transfer the charter to the CEUM, which was the Covenant Congo Church. He further explained that the Free Church mission no longer officially existed and that now they were operating as Evangelical Free Church missionaries operating under a convention agreed upon by the CECU, the Congolese Free Church. Thus, a major shift again for the missionaries, their role on the field, and within the local church. Documents were signed and made official. It was 8:45 a.m., February 5, 1972. One of the areas affected by these changes was special projects. Transferring funds from the U.S. for special projects and channeling them appropriately under the jurisdiction of the CECU further complicated the work of the missionaries. How could they ensure that money raised for medical work, for example, back in the U.S., actually made it for the intended purpose? This new organization chart was a completely new paradigm for the Home Office in the States and the field staff. By the 1980s, things settled down after a tumultuous first 5 years in the 1970s. The work continued and the church continued to grow for both the CECU and the CEUM. I returned to Congo in 1982 through 1983 as a gopher and a high school teacher at Institut Kimya in Gemena, and I don't recall much angst being discussed around the dinner table about the missionary and church relationship. Most everyone had found their places in ministry and accepted their roles, missionaries and church leaders alike. The lines had been drawn, and both sides stayed within those lines for the most part. Thus, ministries grew, and the church grew and matured. It is interesting that the covenant missionaries established a slightly different working relationship with the Congolese church than the Free Church had. Craig Wickstrom, who grew up in Congo, is the current liaison between the Covenant Church in the States and the Congolese Covenant Church. He articulates the working relationship well.
From my observation, the Free Church and the Covenant went different directions starting about 1970. The Free Church kind of said, okay, the missionaries are going to be kind of independent. The church will run things. And the missionaries would act kind of in parallel to them. In the covenant, the missionaries, the decision was to put the missionaries subservient to the church, which was a huge struggle. I remember even when I was in high school, the Free Church missionaries had to buy their own vehicles whereas the covenant still had mission vehicles, which were then owned by the church. In general, the church gave permission to the missionaries to use the vehicles as they felt. It was a different kind of scenario.
The working relationship changed over time.
When we came out in 96, by then, things had changed so that the covenant missionaries were then acting more along the free church line, acting in parallel, not subservient to the church, but in parallel to the church.
But let's step back a bit to the early 1970s. I have already mentioned that there was tension between the West and the East of the ECU. Things were a bit unsettled for everyone, and all hoped for some stability and normalcy to figure out how to work together. But the schism was continuing to brew between the CECU and CEUM. Though Gemina had been agreed upon as a free church mission for decades, it was in 1970 that the Congo Covenant Church made known their desire to establish a presence in Gemina. They started posturing to make this come to be. Recall that years before, when the area was split between the Free Church and Covenant missions, essentially Gemina was the edge of the Free Church's area and all things west. Karawa, located about 50 miles to the east, was designated Covenant, and all things east was their ministry area. There were several reasons for their desire to be in Gemina, one being due to its commerce and urban setting. Craig Wickstrom had lunch with his dad, Marv Wickstrom, in May 2026, and they discussed this time period. Let's listen in to Craig and Marv's lunch conversation.
Do you know what it was that compelled the CUM to push so hard to get into Gemina when that was supposed to be Seikyu territory?
Yeah, I had asked myself the same question when they did it.
Yeah.
And so they're thinking that this is the regional center of political activity for the whole country in that area. So
you think that's why the CUM felt like they needed to be in Gemina, because of the political importance of Gemina?
That's one reason.
Uh-huh.
And the other is that they had this Bokata Road coming into Gemina, and they controlled all of Bokata Road.
Uh-huh.
And then all of the area down to the Tarawa Road, they bordered on Gemina, see. So that was their, geographically, they felt that. And instead of having a Tarawa, they knew that transportation was a problem. And so they wanted to be in Gemina, and they also wanted to be known by people in government that they were there, you know.
In 1972, the churches were in the middle of transferring properties, the charters, and figuring out their new org charts and operations. And the government intervention on religion and the church oversight from the national level in general was causing some upheaval in the church operations. The recent split of the formerly unified MEU into the CECU, Free Church, and CEUM, Covenant, didn't help matters either. Yet the Eastern Church, or Covenant Church, was intent on establishing a presence in Gemina. The Western Church was adamant in refusing to allow them to do so. After all, the turf lines had been agreed to decades ago, and both groups had worked relatively well together, with each side staying in their own sandbox. However, many heated and stormy sessions between the groups were had, and nothing was resolved. So the matter was taken to the government administrator in Gemina. He heard the case, and he ruled that the Covenant Congo Church could operate in a suburb village called Bokonzo, just outside the city limits. Thus, a few miles outside of town, they secured property, and it became the Covenant Church's headquarters, with a few homes for missionaries and pastors initially. Then, in the late 1970s, they started building a very large church, which was dedicated in January 1981. In the late 1980s, they built administrative offices for the CEUM leadership to operate from. They also built a health center with three buildings and a school. Essentially, Bokonzo became the administrative headquarters for the CEUM, the Covenant Congo Church. In conclusion of this fifth episode in the series, we discuss the war from the Simba rebels that caused everyone to evacuate. Dr. Paul Carlson died from a rebel's bullet, but from that sprang the Dr. Paul Carlson Foundation. An airplane was procured, and the Lingala Bible translation was completed. There was a 50-year celebration. The country changed its name, and there was a transition of authority and responsibility to the local Congolese church. A lot happened in this 10-year period. I extend appreciation to Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester for forwarding considerable materials from the Free Church archives. Nils Olberg wrote a master's thesis in 1973 regarding the 50 years of work of the mission and church in the Ubangi region, and considerable information was pulled from that. The mission spotlights were complemented by Paul Noren and Doug Thorpe for Loco and Karawa, respectively. Craig Wickstrom added additional color to the church goings-on. Also, Marv Wickstrom contributed with his thoughts of this time period. Thanks also to the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help make the stories more interesting. In episode 6 of this 7-part series, we will present the period of 1973 to 1997 of our mission work in the northwest corner of Congo. There are two evacuations that occur, and a civil war starts, further disrupting the work of the mission. You will hear the stories of the 4 people who die on the field as well. Thank you for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the next episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kid's life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eales, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninganangai, tikalamalamu. My friends, stay well.